Philadelphia. Indeed, they were the largest class, and they were found especially near Bland's home, by the Schuylkill docks. There were coloreds here, too. I stood catter-corner from Bland's house, watching for a full 10 minutes. I saw a shabbily dressed colored man dart out of the row house next door. He moved down the hot street with speed, and right behind him I saw a colored woman chasing and yelling all manner of vulgarity. And then behind her, an older black woman yelling after and giving chase. And finally, two little colored girls standing in the doorway, wailing. I thought that I might should do something. And then the older woman, a grandmother perhaps, returned and shooed the little girls inside, the door still open. I had heard stories of coloreds like this, different than Raymond and his family, living penny to penny, beaten and run off jobs for daring to apply themselves to that which was held to be white man's work. I had not noticed them at first because it was the relative opulence of all the other coloreds that struck me. But watching there across the street, I remembered that Otha had warned clients of the underground of this fate, for these coloreds were usually runaways themselves, men and women who made no connection with society, with certain churches, and thus found freedom hard upon them. And it occurred to me then that this fear that I felt, this study I put on every face, was their lifetime and worse, for if they were caught by the hounds, no Bland would rally to them. As for the man himself, I found him at home expecting me. A young woman answered the door, smiled, and then called out his name. She introduced herself as Laura, and mentioned that she was Bland's sister. It was a modest house, one of the better ones in the quarter, but not as nice as Raymond's or the White family home on the other side of the river. But it was clean and well appointed. We shook hands, and there were the usual pleasantries. I felt a deep relief at having completed the small task of walking to Bland's home unmolested. And having done that, I was now aware of a gnawing impatience to set upon the work of freedom for Lydia, and thus, in turn, freedom for Sophia, my Sophia. She existed in my mind not as one with her own notions and ideas, but as an idea herself, a notion herself, so that to think of my Sophia was to think of a woman for whom I possessed a true and a sincere feeling, but, too, was to think of my dreams and my redemption. It is important that I tell you this. It is important that you see how little I knew of her dreams, of her redemption. I know now that she had tried to tell me, and I, who so prided himself on listening, simply could not hear. At all events, this was the spirit, anxious and rash, that I brought to Mukaja Bland, so that no more than 5 minutes after taking my seat I said directly and abruptly, "So, how are we going to do it?" "Get to Sophia?" Bland asked. "Well, I was thinking about Lydia and the kids, but we can start with Sophia, if you like." "Sophia is the easy one. I have to prevail upon Corrine and marshal some resources, but it will be done." "Corrine?" As I said her name, my voice trailed off. "She's the one who left Sophia there." "It is her station, Hiram. She deserves notice, and more, deserves consultation." "Corrine..." I shook my head. "You know the full story on that woman?" "No," I said, "except that she has left Sophia down in the coffin." And now something happened, something that I was not aware of at the time. I do not know if it was a kind of possession, but I know that I felt an anger rising in me, an anger related to me, related to my violation, related to the jail and what had been done to me. But it was not my anger. And the voice that now spoke was not mine so much as one recently imprinted upon me. And the voice said, "You know what they did to us back there. You done forgot? You don't remember what they do to the girls down here? And once they do it, they got you. They catch you with the babies, tie you to the place by your own blood." At that moment, the usual calm repose of Bland's face broke and gave way to something in him I had never seen before and never saw again. Fear. And then the walls fell away, and in their place was a great and borderless nothing. The table and chairs were still there, and they, along with Bland himself, were wreathed in a now familiar blue. I was aware of myself and aware of a deep anger, but more I felt a low, guttural pain, one that had been with me since the day I'd left Maynard to the deep. Most important, I was, for the first time, aware of exactly what was happening as it was happening, so that I now thought to try to steer it, direct it, the way you might direct a dream. But the moment I did this, the moment I attempted to directly affect my surroundings, the world reverted back. The great nothing shimmered until the outlines of walls returned. The blue faded, and I saw now that we were seated again, except that we had changed places, and I had taken Bland's seat while he had taken mine. I stood and touched the walls. I walked out of the room, stumbled into the foyer, and then leaned against the wall. There was that same disorientation, though the fatigue was less. I returned to the dining room and took my seat. "That's it, isn't it?" I said. "That's what Corrine wants." "Yes, it is," he said. "Have you seen it before?" "Yes," he said, "but not like that." For long minutes I said nothing. Bland himself now stood and left the room, and I took this as charity, for it seemed to me he knew that I needed a moment to collect myself. When he returned, his sister Laura was with him. She mentioned that it would be time for supper soon and asked me to stay. "Join us, Hiram," said Makaja Bland. "Please." I agreed. After the meal, we took a walk together, silently strolling through the evening Philadelphia streets. And then I finally asked, "Who'd you see do it? Moses?" He nodded. "And that was her the other night?"
"Yes."
"And that was how you saved us?"
"No, we didn't need anything so otherworldly for that bunch."
"Bland, if Moses can do this, why not send her after Otha's family?"
"Because she is Moses, not Jesus. She has her own promises to keep. There are limits to everything. I respect Corrine. I respect what she wanted to do with you, but she does not really understand the power, nor how it works."
We walked some more, wordlessly. The sun was setting behind us. I had not been out for an evening walk since Ryland's hounds had tackled me near the docks. But I felt a kind of safety with Makaja Bland. The fact was, he was my oldest friend on the underground, to the extent that I had any. And it was he who had, in his own particular ways, believed that there was indeed something in me.
"How in God's name did you get tangled up with Corrine?" I asked.
"You have it backward," Bland said. "When I met Corrine, she was a student, a girl at an institute in New York where these Virginians of a certain class would often send their daughters for a ladies' education. French, housekeeping, art, a little reading. But Corrine was precocious, and the city entranced her. She would often sneak out and attend the lectures of abolitionists. That is how she and I met. You see, there were those of us then who'd long felt that we'd like to expand our war into the South. She was easily recruited, and then cultivated as our chief weapon to stab at the heart of demon slavery itself. And she was a weapon, their prim Southern belle, an ornament to their civilization turned back against them. She has proved herself repeatedly, Hiram. You cannot imagine the sacrifice."
"Her own parents," I said.
"Sacrifices, Hiram," he said. "Tremendous sacrifices. The kind that Raymond and Otha and even our Moses would never approve of, nor would I ever ask them to. This was about the time I met you. I was then in the business of reconnaissance under the guise of Mr. Fields. It was there, at Lochless, that I first heard the stories of Santi Bess, but even then I did not make the connection between you, the boy with the invincible memory, and conduction. Lochless was one among the ancient houses that Corrine targeted, but the only one featuring an heir who we believed could be deceived with relative ease. But as she closed in, she realized that the Virginia station stood to gain control not just of an ancient Elm County estate, but of one who could bring a great power into our control.
But you had Moses, I said.
No, Hiram, he said. No one has Moses, certainly not Corrine. Moses has her loyalties, and they are tied most strongly to the station here in Philadelphia. Corrine sought similar power, but tied to Virginia.
So everyone clean? Huh? No one to blame, I said.
No, Hiram, she is not clean. She is right. Have you ever thought about what they would do to her if she were found out? Do you realize what particularly they would do to a woman like that, who mocked their most sacred principles and sought to destroy their whole way of life? We had by now wound our way back to the front of the 9th Street office, my home. It occurred to me, then only emerging from my feelings, that Bland was seeing me home. I looked at him, laughed quietly, and shook my head.
What? He said. We cannot have you getting blackjacked and bound yet again.
I laughed again, a little louder this time. At this, Bland threw his arm around my shoulder and laughed with me. Chapter 19. That night, I sat up replaying the small conduction I had brought about in Bland's home. The power was within me, but it was not in my hands so much as I was in the hands of the power, for when it made itself known, when the blue glow came over and the curtains of fog fell upon me, I was but a passenger in my own body. I needed to understand, and for that I needed someone who already understood, and the only such someone was Moses. But first, the fate of Lydia White and her children. I found myself the next day with Makaja, Otha, and Raymond in the parlor discussing the various means by which we might bring them out.
We need a set of passes, Bland explained, and they need to be in the name of this man, Daniel McKiernan.
Hiram, it was McKiernan who once held Otha and now holds his family. We need these as precise as we can make them. They have a long way to travel, and our agents, they fall on the smallest things. Being out on the roads at an hour forbidden by obscure law, confusing the arrival time for the local ferry, or just bad luck.
I can fabricate the passes, I said, but I need an original sample of his style. As many as possible. Perhaps Otha's free papers.
Nah, Otha said, that don't work. I intrigued with another man to have myself bought from McKiernan, and it was that other man who gave me my papers.
There is another way, said Raymond. There was a time, not too distant, when just across the river it was legal to own a man. In some ways, it still is. Nevertheless, among the men who most advantaged themselves through slavery, there was one of particular importance to my family, Jedekiah Simpson. Mr. Simpson owned me, my mother, my father, and Otha.
This was the man your mother ran from, I asked. The one who sold Otha South?
The same, said Raymond. Now, Jedekiah Simpson is long dead, but his son has taken possession of the old place. He also owns a home here in the city, just north of Washington Square. Elon Simpson, on account of his wealth, is held to be a gentleman in the city's most respectable circles. But we know that he is not respectable at all. We know, for instance, that he kept his investment in slavery by selling his slaves farther south.
Have you ever crossed paths with him? I asked.
No, not yet, Raymond said.
But we got eyes on him, Otha said, both here in the city and on his place down south. And from that we know Elon Simpson still has business with Daniel McKiernan.
Everyone was quiet for a minute, waiting to see if I had yet seen the plot. But they need not have waited. It was forming as they spoke, so I looked to Otha and nodded to confirm my comprehension.
A letter, a receipt of sale, anything, I said. I just need some correspondence between Simpson and McKiernan. A break-in, perhaps.
No, Raymond said. Bland has a more delicate option. They were all three smiling now, like children holding on to a secret.
Tell me, I said.
How about I show you? Bland said.
And so that night, I found myself standing in an alley, with Bland watching the street with a glow of gaslight, positioning ourselves in such a way that the street could not watch us. Our eyes were set on the home of Elon Simpson. We were right off of Washington Square, a part of the city marked by well-appointed brownstones with shuttered windows and a park hailing back to this country's birth. Here was the seat of the city's quality, and the seat of our dead. I had by then done my share of reading on Philadelphia, so I knew that in another time, when the task was here in Pennsylvania, the city had fallen victim to a wave of fever. And among the men who combated this fever was Benjamin Rush, a famous doctor, which is hard to countenance given the theory he put forth in defense of the city. Colored people were immune to the fever, he told Philadelphia, and more than immune, their very presence could alter the air itself, sucking up the scourge and holding it captive in our fetid black bodies. And so tasking men were brought in by the hundreds on the alleged black magic of our bodies. They all died. And when the city began to fill with their corpses, its masters searched for a space far from the whites who were felled by the disease. And they chose a patch of land where no one lived and tossed us into pits. Years later, after the fever had been forgotten, after the war had birthed this new country, they built rows and rows of well-appointed houses right on top of those people, and named a square for their liberating general. It struck me that even here, in the free North, the luxuries of this world were built right on top of us. "How did you come to this?" I asked. We had been standing there for hours, Bland and I, watching the house.
"You mean, to ask how a white man comes to the underground?"
"No. You, particularly. How did you come to this?"
"My father died when I was a child, and my mother could not carry us. I did what I could. I worked whatever job was presented, even at that age. But Laura and I were split from each other, and as soon as I was old enough, I got as far away from home as I could. I was a young man in search of adventure. I went south and fought in the Seminole War and was forever changed. I watched men burn Indian camps, shoot down innocents, and steal children. My own struggles, I realized, could be dwarfed by even greater struggles. I became aware of my lack of sophistication as to why men fight. I had always been curious about the world, but had not had the chance to achieve an education. But then, my mother died, and I returned home to care for Laura. I took work over at the docks, but whenever I had a spare moment, I could be found in the reading rooms of the city, and it was there that I found the cause of abolition and eventually the underground. I worked across the country, Ohio, Indiana, Massachusetts, and then New York, which brought me to Corrine Quinn, and then to Lockless. Bland was about to say more when, at last, the whole reason for our vigil appeared before us. A white man stepped out from the home of Elon Simpson, stood out on the sidewalk, and waited. At this, Bland pulled a cigar from his coat and lit it. He took a puff, and then turned to me, and against the small light from the cigar, I saw him smile. Bland then walked out of the alley and stood in the street. The man moved swiftly toward Bland. Bland turned back to the alley. The man followed him.
"They told me you'd be alone," the man said. "They told me this would be quick and easy."
I wondered for a minute if this were Elon Simpson himself, but even there in the dark I could see that he was not outfitted as a gentleman would be.
"Nothing in life is quick and easy, Chalmers," Bland said. "Nothing important, at least."
"Yeah, well, I did my part," he said.
And at that he handed Bland a package.
"We need to have a look at these," Bland said. "Let's go inside."
"Like hell," Chalmers said. "Quick and easy. That was what your people said. You already wronged me by bringing him with you. Now you want me—"
"I want you to take us inside," Bland said. "It really is simple. You promised papers addressed to a certain person. I need to verify that those papers are what you claim. To do that, I need to be able to read them. To read them, I need light. And the nearest light is inside your master's home."
"Mr. Simpson ain't my master," Chalmers said angrily.
You're right. He isn't. I am. And you're going to take us inside to verify these papers. And if you don't, we are going to send our own papers to this man, this Elon Simpson, who is not your master. And these papers will alert him to the exact nature of all those unchaperoned walks you seem to be in the habit of regularly taking with his sister whenever she visits the city. I'm sure he'd very much enjoy hearing how you have decided to make the scandalizing of his family a part of your regular work. It was too dark to see his expression, but I saw Chalmers take a step back. I imagined what he might be feeling right then, the impulse to run. Perhaps all of his effects were packed. Perhaps this sister had already been alerted. Or perhaps she had not, and he would simply leave her to bear the consequences of the report. Perhaps there was a coach waiting for him that would take him into the merciful arms of family farther north. Or maybe he would adventure out into the Oregon of my imaginings, or take up in the free company of the sailors I loved.
Think carefully, Chalmers, said Makaja Bland. You can take your chances with a gentleman of vast resources, or you can take us inside. No one else has to know. It can all be as a dream. No one has to know, I say. It is just us. We can finish this right now, quick and easy.
Chalmers hesitated a moment and then began walking back toward the house. We followed him up the stairs, then into the foyer and past the salon, and then into a back room that served as Elon Simpson's study. Chalmers drew up the lamplight, and Bland sat behind the desk to read. There were several papers in the bunch, and Bland shuffled through them quickly.
No, he said. None of these will do. Not one.
They said you needed some of Mr. Simpson's papers, said Chalmers. They told me I do this one thing and I am free.
No, I think they told you a good deal more, Bland responded. Did you even bother looking to whom these papers were addressed?
They said bring you papers. I brought you papers.
Well, Bland said, fixing his eyes on me, we're going to need more.
Bland nodded in my direction, stood, and began inspecting the room with the aid of the lamp. Knowing my part, I sat at the desk and began sifting through the drawers. I flipped through a personal journal, scanned a few letters to acquaintances, looked over some invitations, yet found nothing bearing an address to or receipt from McKiernan. But when I looked up again, I saw that Bland was now focused on a small oak chest in the corner. He knelt down and rubbed his hand over the iron lock. Then, standing again, Bland reached into his pocket and produced a small satchel, and from the satchel he drew a wire. I watched Bland work at the lock and then looked over to Chalmers, who was now seated in a high back armchair, fiddling nervously. Bland worked the lock for a minute or two, then he looked over to Chalmers and smiled as the top of the chest groaned open. Reaching in, Bland retrieved a large stack of neatly opened envelopes and put them on the desk. As soon as I began to sort through them, it was clear that these letters were a different sort of communication. They were records of transactions, records of people managed, bought, and sold. The volume of business was brisk, and the numbers appended to the people made it clear that these dealings were the root of Elon Simpson's wealth. I had never seen either Simpson, but I could not help but imagine the son here, among the northern quality, presenting himself as a man of society, a man of good breeding, reputable connections, and respectable business. But shut away in that footlocker was his unwashed life, the proof of a great crime, evidence of his membership in the dark society that underwrote this opulent home, which was itself built upon a sprawling grave in the heart of this alleged slaveless city. There were several letters from McKiernan. I took all of them. The more samples I had, the better.
But he'll know they're gone, Chalmers protested.
Only if you tell him, said Bland.
Chalmers followed us to the door.
Someone will be in touch with you next week. We have good intelligence that Mr. Simpson, your not master, will not be back before then. The letters will be returned to you. Put them back into the chest and close it up, Bland said. And then you'll be done with us. Quick and easy.
It only took a couple of days for me to write the passes, along with a few letters testifying to Bland's references in some of the more treacherous regions where he'd be traveling. We had the documents back to Chalmers a day later, and we never heard from him again. Even after things went as they did, nothing was ever traced back to Raymond, Otha, or anyone else at our station. Bland headed to Alabama shortly after. I didn't get to say farewell. I have so rarely been afforded the right of farewell, but this one seemed more significant, as the full plan was made good to me by Raymond. It was the most daring rescue anyone in Philadelphia had ever undertaken. The plan would send Bland west, where he'd take up haven with one of the more capable agents in Cincinnati. He would scout the Ohio River and find some sort of appropriate landing either in Indiana or Illinois. Once Bland had found a safe landing, he would venture deep into slave country, into the heart of the coffin, Florence, Alabama, and make contact with a Hank Pearson, an old and trusted friend of Otha's, still on the McKiernan place. Hank would then bring Lydia, who would know Bland by the possession of a shawl she'd given to Otha as a remembrance of her. Then, posing as their owner, Bland would lead the family back out. Should they become separated, the passes would certify the right of Lydia and her children to be on the road. The plan was not simply daring in its steps, but in its timing. It was early August, a long way from those seemingly endless winter nights that offered an agent of the underground so much cover. But it had to be done just then, for it was said that McKiernan was on hard times and might at any point start selling off hands, and then our knowledge and planning would be lost. Chapter 20. It was now the end of summer, the slow season for rescues, so that we would have had little to do but await news of Bland's mission. But fortunate for us, the time coincided with an annual gathering of all those who made legitimate and open war against slavery. Concerned citizens who, through the journals, oratory, and ballot, fought for abolition. We in the underground fought a secret war, covert, mystical, violent, but were quietly allied with the open one, and the August meeting was the only time when our two factions, hailing from across the country, could meet. The prospect of a reunion with Virginia with Corrine filled me with apprehension. After Bland's departure, we began to make our preparations, and 2 weeks later, we were off, Raymond, Otha, and I, aboard a private stage, so that as Bland now made his way south, we endeavored to make our way farther north, into the mountainous region of New York. I was coming to understand that Raymond and Otha fought on both fronts of the war, were leading lights among the abolitionists while keeping their hands in the darker business into which I had been drawn. No station east of the Mississippi conducted more colors into freedom than those brought through Philadelphia. Adding to that fame was the odyssey of Otha from the depths of Alabama, from the depths of orphanage into the waiting arms of his family. But on the second night of our carriage ride, we were joined by one whose regard outstripped us all, Moses. I now knew her not simply as a creature of legend, but through the many exploits detailed in Raymond's files. Still, when she stepped into the coach carrying with her the heir of all her adventures, I was so dazzled I barely managed a greeting. She exchanged warm pleasantries with Raymond, nodded at Otha, and then held her gaze on me. "How are you holding up, friend?" she asked. It took a moment before I remembered that when she'd last seen me, I was recovering from Ryland's assault. "Well," I said. She had with her a walking stick, as she did that same night I'd seen her out in the woods, and now, in the daylight, I could see that it had across its body a series of carvings and glyphs. She saw me studying the thing and said, "My trusty walking stick, stripped from a branch of the sweet gum tree, goes wherever I do." The coach rolled on. I found it incredibly difficult to not stare. Even without her power of conduction, she was the most daring agent on the underground. I had seen enough of the world, had read enough of Raymond's files, to know that hers was a soul scarred but not broken by the worst of slavery, And I thought then back to my burial in the hole, the time in the jail, and those nights when I was hunted as prey. Perhaps I needed it. Perhaps I had to see more of it, to know for myself how low and evil it all really could be. Raymond called this woman Harriet, a name she claimed to prefer over all her other titles. But still, he gave her all the respect a soldier might give a great general, answering all her questions while posing few of his own in return, waiting upon her constantly, though she rarely requested anything. A day later, we rolled into the convention, campsite nestled in a cleared field not far from the border of Canada. The land belonged to one of the great benefactors of the underground, who it was said had plans to resettle a community of coloreds here to task only for themselves. Rain had come a day before our arrival, and as we unloaded from the coach, we sloshed in our brogans. The three of us claimed a space on the outskirts of this camp, toward higher ground, and then dispersed, each to his own way. I looked out and saw mud-streaked tents extending to the edges of the woods, and then, walking amongst them, saw conventioners in humor and debate. And then in the larger tents, I saw orators of reform preaching their cause from makeshift platforms. The orators loved spectacle and seemed to be vying with each other to bring followers to their cause. I waded through the throngs of listeners and paused before a white man in calico breeches and top hat who just at that moment was weeping uncontrollably into the sleeve of his coat. Through his tears, he told a tale which held the audience rapt of how rum and lager had stripped him of his home and family, until all he had were the clothes in which he was now dressed. And he was resolved, he said, now recovering himself, to remain garbed in this same costume until the curse of spirits was purged from the land. I walked farther. I stopped before a crush of people and watched as two women, both in overalls with shaven heads, declaimed on the rights of women to appear with all of the freedoms of men, in all the same spheres. And as the women went on, their pitch and volume grew, until not even the gathered audience was spared, for the women now asserted that until we, too, resolved to take up the cause of suffrage in this very assembly, we were partners in that vast conspiracy to pillage half the world. And this pillage continued, I realized, moving farther to still another tent, where a white man stood beside a silent Indian in traditional dress. And the white man spoke of the great depredations he had seen, the iniquitous lengths these Georgians, Carolinians, and Virginians would commit themselves to in the name of land. And by then, I well knew what would be done upon that land, how the sin of theft would be multiplied by the sin of bondage. Farther along I went until I caught sight of a line of children who stood behind a man raging against the factories of this country. The children had been sold into drudgery by parents who could no longer afford them, until they were saved by the beneficence of the society the man represented. Solely through these efforts of charity, the children would be bound to school and rescued from the evils of capital. And farther still, I found that this argument was cousin to another, made from a trade unionist, who insisted that the titles of all factories should be stripped from their luxuriating owners and given to those who toiled in them. And still farther was another related argument made that day, that the factory be rejected in total, that society be condemned a dead letter, and that men and women organize themselves in new communities where all worked together and owned everything in common. And even this was not the pinnacle of the convention's radicalism, for at the farthest edges of camp, I found a spinster who insisted that I and everyone rebuff even the bonds of marriage, which was itself a kind of property, a kind of slavery, and ally myself with the doctrine of free love. It was late morning now. The sun beat down out of the cloudless August sky. I wiped my brow with my jacket sleeve and sat for a moment on a tree stump, away from the fray of conventioners and tents. It was all so much. An entire university out on that green. New ways of being, new ideas of liberation, now intruded upon me. Only a year ago, I would have rejected them all. But I had seen so much now, so much beyond even all that I had beheld in my father's books. Where did it end? I could not tell, and this fact both pained me and filled me with joy. When I looked up, I saw a woman, just older than me, standing at the edge of the camp area from where I had just emerged, regarding me closely. When our eyes met, she smiled and approached directly. She had a delicate, light brown face, framed by thick black hair that flowed down her cheeks and then to her shoulders. I stood out of respect, and her smile now disappeared. She surveyed me from head to foot, as though trying to be sure of something, and then she said the last thing I expected to hear.
"How are you, Hi?"
Had I heard this elsewhere, under other circumstance, it would have been a relief, for I would have been filled with thoughts of home. Immediately I began shuffling through a deck of questions, uppermost being how this woman had gotten hold of my name.
"It's all right," she said. "It's all going to be all right now."
Then she extended a hand and said,
"I'm Kessia."
I declined her greeting, but she continued on, registering no insult.
"I'm from your place, Elm County, Virginia. Lockless. You don't remember me. You remember everything, but you don't remember me. It's all right. I used to look after you when you were a baby. Your mother would leave you with me when she had to..."
"Who?"
"Your mother. Mama Rose, we called her. She would leave you with me. And the way I have heard it, you know mine. Thena is her name. She lost her children some years ago. All five of them sold on the racetrack of Starfall, sent off to God knows where. But I am here now with the Underground. And I have heard that there was one who was here, too, who came up just as I did. And I have heard that that one is you."
"Can we walk?" I asked.
"We surely can," she said.
I led her farther away from the convention toward the outer portion of the green, on higher ground, where we had tied up our coach and pitched our tent. I helped her into the seat and then climbed up and seated myself next to her.
"It's true," she said, looking straight ahead. "It's all true. I can tell you how it happened, if you like."
"I most certainly would like," I said.
"Well, it's as I told you, you know. I'm Thena's baby, her oldest one. We live down on the street, and I have some fond memories of that time. My daddy was a big man in those days, a head man on the tobacco team. That is to say, he was about as big as you can be when you was tasked. We had our own house at the end of the street, set off from the others, and bigger, too. I thought this was all on account of my daddy and the high esteem in which he was held by those up top. He was a hard man. I do not remember him speaking much, but I recall that when the quality came down to address him, they spoke with him in a kind of respect that they accorded no other tasking man."
And Kessia paused here, and a look of realization came over her. Then she said,
"Or perhaps that is all in my mind. Perhaps it is the memory of a child trying to recall things as I would have liked it to have been. I don't know. But I do have it that way, I tell you. I remember the games we used to play. I remember the marbles. I remember the ball and string. I remember playing the night and the whistle, but mostly I remember my mama, who was as warm and lovely a woman as I ever did know. I remember Sundays just laying up in her bosom, all five of us, like kittens. My daddy was a hard man, but I think I knew even then that something about him had protected us, that he was doing something or had done something for all of us to have that cabin set off at the end. We had our own garden out back, our own camellias, and that was my life."
Kessia was looking out over toward the tents we had just left, lost in a reverie. I was lost in my own, remembering Thena all those years ago, puffing on her pipe and recalling that man she loved, Big John. It seemed incredible to me that this Kessia could be their daughter, could be here, of all places.
But I got bigger and was soon put to work. At first, carrying water out to the folks in the field, and then, after that, in the fields myself. But I did not mind. All my friends were there, too, and I was close to my daddy. It was hard labor, that I knew, but I was always inclined to hard labor. It's what put me here on the underground. But back then, my world was the fields and the street, and the street is how I knew you, Hi. Knew your mother and knew your Aunt Emma. On weekends, the older folks would go down to the woods for their little dances and would leave me to watch over the babies, and you was one of those. I am not so surprised to find you here. You were always different. You just watched everything. And I was thinking when I spotted you up here how you have not changed, how you were just watching. It is my blessing to find you, to meet you again out here, so far from the task. It was such a different time, and it amazes me, shames me almost, to say that I was happy back there. But I do believe I was, for a time, and I recall when the feeling changed. It was when my daddy fell. Fever, you know. That hit my mama hard. She was still warm as ever, but she was so grieved, would cry every night and call us to her. Come in and rest with your mama, she would say, and we, all of us kittens, would lay there with her, and she would just cry, and all of us would cry with her. But I tell you, Hi, this was nothing measured against what was coming. At least when my daddy passed, we had each other. But, well, soon, we ain't even had that. It was like all of us passed from each other, like all of us died and was damned to a different hell.
Kessie now turned to me and said,
"They say you knew my mama a little."
I nodded and intended to say no more, for I could not yet bring myself to fully accept the story. But I could see Kessie regarding me with expectant eyes, an expectation I knew well. "She was not exactly as you say it here," I said, "but I believe it was the same woman. And more, I believe she had reason to be as she was, as I knew her. But I don't think that much matters. What matters is that she was good to me. That, for me, Fina was the best part of Lochless." Kessie cupped her hands and brought them to her face so that they covered her nose and mouth, and she cried gently and quietly. And then she said,
"So, you know about the racetrack?"
"I do," I said.
"Imagine that. All of us, my brothers and sisters, taken out there and sold. Do you know, I never saw them again. Do you know how hard I have tried to find them? But there are so many gone, Hi, like water between my fingers. Gone."
I know," I said. "I did not always know, but I know now. Your mother, she tried to tell me, but I did not always know what it meant to be handled as such. But I am seeing it now."
"They used to say your daddy was a white man."
"He was," I said.
"Didn't save you, did it?"
"No. Don't save none of us."
"Nope. It don't. And I am here before you only on a chance. Most of mine was taken Natchez way. But I was carried off up to Maryland and put to work out in the timbers. And not so long after, I met this man, Elias, and we took a shine to each other. Elias was a freeman who worked for his own wage, and he planned to buy me off so that I might live free too. Timbers was hard labor, but I found me another family. I refashioned myself for that new life, formed myself around that man, and I got to something close to happy. I knew that I could never again be a girl, and I knew that I was marked very harshly by what had come before. But I found something. And just when I did, I tell you, they endeavored to put me right back on the block. But I had something for them this time, you see. I had married into a family of a particular sort, and among that family there was the one who you know as Moses.
And Kessie was now laughing to herself at the thought of it.
You should have seen it. Me and Elias had said our farewells. It had been so hard. And then the day of he shows up in the auction and starts bidding. And my heart is leaping because it's him and some other man all the way from Texas. And they go back and forth until my Elias look at me with the saddest eyes. And I know he done lost. And Texas done won. And Texas pays his money and shuts me up in a cell. You should have heard him and all his intentions. He was so high and mighty.
Sunrise, we'll be off, he tells me.
Ha, sunrise. He don't know. Sun comes sure enough, but Moses got there first.
Moses, I thought. Conduction. Now Kessia looked at me.
It was a plan, you see. They bid me up as high as they could, made the man pay, and then got me out. My Lord, after I seen what Moses had done to them, I could not go back to that life. I thought of all the hell they had given me, and I thought of how good it felt to give some back in good measure. And I thought of all my pains and how many more there were like me. And all I wanted thereafter was to be on this underground. I've been with Moses ever since. That's how I heard about you, huh? Some boy, they tell me, come up from Virginia, Elm County, my county. And I start to check him, and I hear your name, and I could not believe it. But my God, it was you. Soon as I seen you here wandering and watching, I knew it was you.
At that she threw herself on me and embraced me. And when she did, much to my surprise, I was warmed. I had been away from home so long, and now there I was with some memory of it, with someone else who had made the same journey. It was getting late, and we each had to find our people. We stood and embraced again, and she said,
"We'll have more time, you and I. We will have more days here."
Then she looked at me and said,
"Oh, my, I don't know how I forgot to ask. Been talking so much myself. How is Mama Rose? How is your mother?"
Soon, I was walking again among the tents and saw the exhortation had given way to amusements. There were teams of jugglers who tossed fruit and bottles amongst each other. There were daredevils who extended a thin cable between the heights of two trees and walked across once and then danced their way back again while singing a tune. There were acrobats who tumbled and twisted and leaped in midair. And how was my mother? How fared Mama Rose? I still had no recollection of her, only the stories assembled from those like Kessia who'd known her, so that when I thought of her, it was like a scene sketched of some ancient myth, not like I remembered Sophia, not like I remembered Thina. Thina, who had never been more alive to me than she was in that moment with Kessia, with the recollections of the daughter mixing with my own. And I felt that I now understood so much. Then I knew why she had been so hard with me. Her injunction, "I am more your mother standing right here now than that white man on that horse is your father." We all joined for supper, Gotha, Raymond, Kessia, Moses, and I. And afterward, with the sun now low in the sky, a group of colored folk assembled around a bonfire. They began, in the slowest, most haunting voices, to sing the songs that could only be made down in the coffin. I had not heard these songs since I had left, and hearing them now, I felt them tugging at me. I felt myself swaying in the August heat. It was all too much. I left and went to Rome with my thoughts, among the muddy byways between the rows of tents. I sat down on a patch of dry grass just beyond the tents, where I could still hear my people singing in the distance. I was reeling from the day. Kessia, the memories of Thina and Big John, the arguments and ideas about women, children, labor, land, family, and wealth. It occurred to me that an examination of the task revealed not just those evils particular to Virginia, to my old world, but the great need for a new one entirely. Slavery was the root of all struggle, for it was said that the factories enslaved the hands of children, and that childbearing enslaved the bodies of women, and that rum enslaved the souls of men. In that moment I understood, from that whirlwind of ideas, that this secret war was waged against something more than the taskmasters of Virginia, that we sought not merely to improve the world, but to remake it. I was pulled out of my thoughts by a man milling around nearby. I was greeted by a messenger who handed me a parcel with a seal, which I immediately recognized as the mark of Maccajah Bland. My heart leapt. My greatest urging then was to open this letter. But it was Otha's family, and it should be he who first understood their fate. I found him with Raymond still near the bonfire, still enraptured by the slave songs that were ringing out. I handed the letter to Raymond, who was the better reader. On Otha's face, alight with the bonfire's glow, was all the trepidation we could expect. But then Raymond smiled and said, "Maccajah Bland has Lydia and the children. They have passed out of Alabama. At the time of this letter, they were traversing Indiana."
"My God," said Otha, "my God."
He turned to me and said, "It's going to happen. After all these years, my Lydia, my boys, all of them, my God, I wish Lambert had made it to see this." Otha then turned back to Raymond and burst into tears. Raymond broke his usual solemn mask and held Otha close as they wept. I turned away thinking they needed their time, overrun by a day filled with more wonders than I could fathom. Chapter 21. Once I'd dreamed of ruling, as my father had done, back at Lochless. And it was tough to say it as such, that it was my dream, even if I had not thought it all through. But I had found the underground, or the underground had found me, and for this fact, I was at last happy. On the underground, I found meaning. In Raymond White, in Otha, in Maccajah, I found family. And now in Kesia, I felt that I had even found some lost part of myself. The next evening, after another day of exhortations and amusements, I decided to walk through the woods, high into the hills above the field, and that's where I saw her, Moses, seated on a large rock, her legs folded. She was still and at peace, and I thought perhaps to leave her to her thoughts, but when I began to walk away, I heard a voice cut through the quiet night air. "Evening." I turned and saw her already walking toward me, her eyes fixed on my head. When close enough, she reached out to feel the spot where I had taken Ryland's blow. Then she stepped back, smiled, and said, "I knew we would have our time to speak, and it is good to do so out here, far removed from them. Heard a lot about you," she said. "And then Kesia said you spoke more just yesterday." "Yes," I said. "We're from the same home place, as it happens." "Uh-huh. She told me as much. Good to see someone from home, ain't it? Did you have some sense of roots? It must be hard on you to be so far from your roots."
"Aren't we all?" I asked.
"No," she said. "Me, I'm home fairly often, even if the masters would like it different. I work in one place, and it is the place I know best, the far shore of Maryland, my home. Some day I shall return there for good, but not like this, not as no agent, but in the bright and open sun. But in the by time, I'm there fairly often, and it is good to get back, good to remember."
"I remember plenty," I said.
"I know you do. Way I hear it, your talent is such that you are as good working in the House of Philadelphia as you were in the fields of Virginia. And I have heard it whispered that you particularly might be able to work even more
I've heard that too, I said. But it's all horse and no saddle.
Huh, she said. Give it time.
I think it ain't really up to me. I want my people out. But I see it. There are so many people. And I can see them all now.
Oh, I am so glad to hear you say that, she said.
She was smiling at me mischievously, and I felt, in fact, knew that I had just enrolled myself into something.
Here is the thing, friend. I work small, and I work alone. I move by my own time and my particular vigilance. But for this one job, I need a man who runs least well as he writes. And I am told that you are one of the few this side of the underground who qualifies.
Can't see why you would need any help from me. I know they call you Moses, and that name comes out of a majestic power, don't it?
Majestic, she said. That's a big word for something so simple.
But the stories, I said. I know what they say. Moses tamed oxen as a girl and harrowed the fields like a man. Moses talked to the wolves. Moses brought the clouds to earth. Knives melt upon the garments of Moses. Bullwhips turned to ash in the slave master's hand. She laughed.
That what they say, huh?
That and a lot more.
Well, here's what I will tell you, she said. My methods are not for the offering. It's the underground, not the overground. This ain't no show. I don't advertise like Box Brown. Put before something they can't understand, people got a tendency to talk, and also to make something bigger than what they actually saw. However it play, understand that talk don't come from me. I speak no more than required, and leave the passenger to their colors and wide tails. And as for names, I answer to one, Harriet.
So, no conduction, then? I asked.
Big words, she said. All I want to know is, you ready to work? I'm headed back home, and you have been recommended to me as one who could well do a turn. So do you wish to work, or do you want to while away the hours quizzing me?
Of course, I want to work. When do we leave, and who are we after? It was only then that I heard the eagerness in my own voice, the powerful desire to work with this woman of whom I had heard so many stories. I am sorry, I said. I stand ready whenever you would have it.
Go on back to the camp, she said. Enjoy the show.
She then walked back to her boulder and, turning away from me, said,
We be moving soon enough. Might even get ye that saddle.
The next morning, I woke up to a grand commotion outside the tent. I heard Otha's voice lost in a kind of hysteria. And then I heard Raymond and some others whom I did not recognize. They were trying to calm him, and I think right then I must have known because, no matter our troubles, Otha almost never was one for such commotion. Something truly terrible must have come. I stepped outside the tent. It was barely first light, but I could clearly see Otha's head buried in the shoulder of his brother, and he was swaying almost, barely able to stand. Raymond saw me first. His eyes widened and he shook his head. Otha, perhaps sensing me there, broke away from his brother and turned to me. I saw an entire funeral on his face.
Have you heard? Otha asked me. Have you heard what they done did?
I did not answer. Hiram, Raymond said, we can explain it all later. We have to. And at that, Raymond just shook his head in disbelief and tried to guide Otha away. Come on, Otha, he said. Come on.
Come on where? Otha said. Where can we go, Raymond, for the doing of what? It's over. Can't you see that it's over? They got Lydia in the coffin. Where we gonna go? Mikaja Bland is dead. Where can any of us go?
And then Othah turned to me.
Did you hear that, Hiram?
He asked. And I saw that his face had gone from pain to rage.
Did you hear what they did? They killed him, chained his body, bashed in his head, and threw him in the river.
And Othah burst into tears as he said this. And Raymond and several of the men pulled him away from the tent. He nearly came to blows with them at first. He yelled and screamed and kicked until Raymond took hold of him. Now they led him, almost carried him away, and I could hear Othah yelling the whole time.
Did you hear what they done did? McGodge Bland is in the water, and what we gonna do now?
I stood there, rooted, until I could no longer see them. And then I stood there longer, struck wholly dumb. When I came out of it, I saw that there was a commotion all around me. The news was spreading across the camp. I could see people talking amongst each other in groups, and those